of the depth, complexities, contradictions, and nuances that make up the stories of each of our lives. Audrey's 6-year-old daughter, Jossie, woke her up in the middle of the night. Jossie was scared because of the movie they'd seen about a puppy's mother who ran away and never came back. Audrey assumed Jossie was worried about being abandoned herself, and she explained to Jossie, "I would never run away and leave you by yourself." But it turned out that that wasn't what Jossie was worried about at all. She was anxious about her new turtle. The movie had caused her to wonder whether her turtle might be someone's mother, and whether there was a baby turtle somewhere that needed its mother. In fact, Jossie's turtle was a baby itself, but Jossie didn't know that and was consumed with fear and guilt. Audrey had fallen into the trap of listening to her own internal voice rather than to her daughter. Her internal voice was saying, "I already know what this is all about," and that was the end of her curiosity. Another way to rekindle your curiosity is to keep focused on your purpose in the conversation. If your purpose is to persuade or win or get the other person to do something, your internal voice will be saying things in line with those purposes, such as, "Why don't you just do this? It's obviously the best answer." If instead you hold as one of your primary purposes understanding the other person, it motivates your internal voice to ask questions such as, "What else do I need to know for that to make more sense?" Or, "I wonder how I can understand the world in such a way that what they're saying makes sense." Sometimes you'll find that your internal voice is just too strong to take on. You try to negotiate your way to curiosity, but you just can't get there. If you're sitting on feelings of pain or outrage or betrayal, or conversely, if you're overcome with joy or love, then listening may be a hopeless task. Listening certainly feels out of reach for Delilah as she learns that Heather, her roommate of 6 months, is bisexual. As Heather talks, Delilah sits, feeling confused, embarrassed, and angry. Rather than pretending to listen, Delilah needs to do the opposite. To remain authentic in the conversation, she needs first to be honest about what she's thinking and feeling. "I'm glad you trust me enough to tell me this, and I really want to listen. At the same time, this is really, really upsetting for me. I'm feeling awkward, like I'm not sure how to act around you anymore." Delilah and Heather have a tough conversation ahead. Not only will each of them have strong feelings to sort through and share, but they have very different views about sexuality. As they talk about their friendship and how to handle their ongoing rooming situation, it will be critically important that each has the ability to listen to the other. At times, to be able to listen, they'll need to speak. When you find yourself in this situation, let the other person know that you want to listen, that you care about what they have to say, but that you can't listen right now. Often it's enough to give a headline of what you're thinking. "I'm surprised to hear you say that. I think I disagree, but say more about how you see it." Or, "I have to admit that as much as I want to hear what you have to say, I'm feeling pretty defensive right now." With that on the table, you can get back to listening, knowing that you've signaled your difference and will get back to your view in time. In some cases, you may decide that you can neither listen nor talk. This may be because you're too upset or confused, or simply because you need to do something else. Rather than give the other person half your attention, it's better to say, "This is important to me. I want to find time to talk about it, and right now I'm not able to." Managing your internal voice is not easy, especially at first, but it's at the heart of good listening. Your internal stance may be the key to good listening, but even so, there are some specific techniques we can pass along, some how-tos that people find helpful. In addition to the stance of curiosity, there are three primary skills that good listeners employ: inquiry, paraphrasing, and acknowledgement. In any difficult conversation, we should inquire to learn, and only to learn. You can tell whether a question will help the conversation or hurt it by thinking about why you've asked it. The only good answer is to learn. One thing to watch for are statements disguised as questions. Anyone who has ever been a kid in a car has uttered the cranky words, "Are we there yet?" You know you're not there yet, and your parents know you know, and so they respond in a tone as cranky as yours. What you really meant was, I'm feeling restless, or I wish we were there, or this is a really long trip for me. Any of these would likely elicit a more productive response from mom and dad. This illustrates an important rule about inquiry. If you don't have a question, don't ask a question. Never dress up an assertion as a question. Doing so creates confusion and resentment, because such questions are inevitably heard as sarcastic and sometimes even mean-spirited. Consider some examples of assertions disguised as questions. Are you going to leave the refrigerator door open like that? Instead of, please close the refrigerator door. Or, I feel frustrated when you leave the refrigerator door open. Is it impossible for you to focus on me just once? Instead of, I feel ignored, or I'd like you to pay more attention to me. Do you have to drive so fast? Instead of, I'm feeling nervous, or it's hard for me to relax when I'm not in control. Notice that these examples of disguised assertions are either about feelings or about requests. That's not surprising. Sharing our feelings and making requests are two things that many of us have difficulty doing directly. They can make us feel vulnerable. Turning what we have to say into an attack, a sarcastic question, can feel safer. But this safety is an illusion, and we lose more than we gain. Saying, I'd like you to pay more attention to me, is more likely to produce a conversation and a satisfying outcome than, is it impossible for you to focus on me just once? Why? Because instead of hearing the underlying feeling or request, the other person focuses on the sarcasm and on the attack. Instead of hearing that you feel lonely, they hear that you think they are thoughtless. The real message doesn't get through, because they're distracted by the need to defend themselves. In fact, they're likely to respond in kind. Well, sure, I can focus on you just this once. And things deteriorate from there. A second error that gets us into trouble is using questions to shoot holes in the other person's argument. For example, you seem to think this is my fault, but surely you'd agree that you made more mistakes than I did, wouldn't you? Or, if it's true that you did everything you could have done to make the sale, how do you explain the fact that Kate was able to make it so soon after you gave up? These questions are wrong-footed from the start. They emerge from a purpose of trying to persuade the other person that you are right and they are wrong, rather than trying to learn. To use the ideas in these questions constructively, pull out the statements embedded in the questions and express them, but not as facts. Rather than asserting them as true, share them as open questions or perceptions, and ask for the other person's reaction. Rather than assuming that this is an argument they have ignored, assume that they have thought about it and have reason to tell a different story. You might say, for example, I understand that you feel you did everything you could to make the sale. To me, though, that seems inconsistent with the fact that Kate made the sale right after you gave up. What's your thinking about that? This kind of open-ended question gives the other person broad latitude in how to answer. It elicits more information than yes-no questions or offering menus such as, were you trying to do A or B? Instead ask, what were you trying to do? This way you don't bias the answer or distract their thinking by the need to process your ideas. It lets them direct their response toward what is important to them. Typical open-ended questions are variations on, tell me more, and help me understand better. To understand where the other person's conclusions came from and enrich your understanding of what they envision going forward, it also helps to ask them to be more explicit about their reasoning and their vision. What leads you to say that? Can you give me an example? What would that look like? How would that work? How would we test that hypothesis? Consider the situation Ross ran into with his boss. He received a flyer for a professional seminar he wanted to take. It would help him in his job as a product manager, so he figured the conversation with his boss about getting the time off and the course paid for would be a cinch. He was wrong. The conversation went like this.
For me to even consider having you take this course, I need more evidence that you're dedicated to working here for the long term. Right now, I just don't see it.
What? I'm totally dedicated to the company. I've told you that. That's the whole point of me wanting to take this seminar.
Well, I don't see it that way. I get the sense you view this job as a stepping stone to something else.
Well, I mean, I don't know what else to say except that I love it here and plan to stay. And the seminar would be very helpful for the work that I do.
It's not hard to see why this is an unproductive exchange. There's virtually no information being transferred back and forth. In essence, Ross's boss is saying, I don't think you're dedicated, but I'm not going to tell you why. And unfortunately, Ross isn't asking. After some coaching, Ross took up the issue again, but this time asked for more concrete information.
Say more about how you judge dedication and what you've observed in me that suggests to you that I'm not as dedicated as you'd like me to be.
Well, obviously it's a lot of things. One piece of it is that you seem uninterested in the social events here. In my experience, anyway, it's been a pretty good indicator of dedication. People who are in this for the long haul, they know the importance of building and maintaining good relationships with their coworkers. So they make sure to get to as many social events as possible.
Huh. I am totally surprised to hear you say that. I was assuming you measured dedication based on things like working late and doing a lot of assignments well.
Well, that's very important, too. But sometimes people do it just to build a good record for when they decide to move on to the next job. In my experience, the socializing aspect is actually most tightly correlated to long-term interest.
Finally, Ross and his boss were getting somewhere. By the end of the conversation, they had a much deeper understanding of why they each reached a different conclusion about Ross's commitment to the company. Important information for Ross to know. You should also ask questions about the three conversations. Each of the three conversations provides fertile ground for curiosity. Can you say a little more about how you see things? What information might you have that I don't? How do you see it differently? What impact have my actions had on you? Tell me a little more about why you think this was my fault. Were you reacting to something I did? How are you feeling about all of this? Say more about why this is important to you. What would it mean to you if that happened? If the answers aren't entirely clear, keep digging. If necessary, say what's still unclear or inconsistent to you and ask for clarification. Okay, so your view is that Kate made the sale because she could offer a reduced price on the service contract. I can see how that would make a difference. What I'm still unclear on, though, is why you couldn't offer the same deal. Can you say a little more about that? Still, sometimes even the most skillful question provokes defensiveness. You ask a question out of genuine caring toward the other person and a genuine desire to learn, and still they react by shutting down, defending, counterattacking, accusing you of bad intentions, or changing the subject. One response is to say that you're trying to help and that there's no need for them to be defensive, and then continue to press for an answer. But this can be experienced as an attempt to control, provoking further resistance. It's better to make your question an invitation rather than demand, and to make that clear. The difference is that an invitation can be declined without penalty. This offers a greater sense of safety, and especially if the other person declines to respond and your reaction makes that okay, it builds trust between you. Whether you are talking with your boss or your 8-year-old daughter, giving them the choice of whether to answer increases the chance that they will respond and respond honestly. Even if they don't answer now, they may later, after they think about it. Knowing that it's their choice underscores your caring intent and frees them to think about the question. The second skill a good listener brings to the conversation is paraphrasing. Paraphrasing is when you express to the other person, in your own words, your understanding of what they're saying. There are two significant benefits to paraphrasing. First, paraphrasing gives you a chance to check your understanding and gives the other person a chance to say, well, no, that's not quite right. What I really meant was... Second, paraphrasing lets the other person know they've been heard. Usually the reason someone repeats himself or herself in a conversation is because they have no indication that you've actually taken in what they've said. If you notice that the other person is saying the same thing over and over again, take it as a signal that you need to paraphrase more. Once they feel heard, they're significantly more likely to listen to you. They'll no longer be absorbed by their internal voice and can focus on what you have to say. Consider this conversation between Rachel and Ron, a married couple who frequently argue about how strictly to observe Shabbat, the Jewish Sabbath, and its traditional rules restricting travel.
I told Chris I'd come by tomorrow.
Ron, tomorrow's Saturday. You know you can't drive over to Chris's on Shabbat. Besides, we've got temple in the morning.
Well, I know, but I told Chris I'd come. It's the only day he had available.
Well, I think it's important for us to go to services as a family. Why don't you go over there on Sunday?
Well, Chris can't do it on Sunday. He's got church and stuff.
Oh, I get it. So his religious practices are more important than ours.
Neither Rachel nor Ron feels heard in this conversation. If they're going to break this cycle, one of them has to decide to listen and to paraphrase. Let's assume that Ron decides to try.
I told Chris I'd come by tomorrow.
Ron, tomorrow's Saturday. You know you can't drive over to Chris's on Shabbat. Besides, we've got temple in the morning.
It sounds like my making plans is frustrating you.
You bet it's frustrating. I assumed we were going.
So part of the problem is that I made plans without consulting you?
No, it's more that I hate being the one who always has to nag us to go to temple.
You feel like I make you the one responsible for our religious life?
Yeah. I mean, I hate feeling like the Shabbat police. Plus, I worry about the message it sends to the kids.
So you're afraid that if the kids see me breaking the Sabbath, they won't take it seriously?
Yeah, that's part of it. But it's a lot of things. You know, it's lonely when I go by myself. And I want you to go to temple because you want to go, not because I'm making you go.
Well, I can see how that would be lonely. And I do want to go for myself. I think that sometimes when I feel pressured to go, I resist because I don't like being told what to do. And sometimes I feel like I'm following the spirit of the law by doing other things.
Yeah, like what?
Well, like helping out Chris. He's having a really tough time in his marriage right now, and I wanted to try to spend some time with him. That makes me feel like I'm connecting with people in our community, which is part of what I get out of services. And I'd like the kids to see that caring for people is a big part of what this is all about. Maybe we could talk to them about this.
Well, that would help.
But that might not meet your interest in going to services together, or not wanting to carry the weight of responsibility for it in our family. Can you say some more about that?
This time, Rachel and Ron are starting to get somewhere in a complex and emotionally charged issue. Ron's paraphrasing lets Rachel know that he is trying to understand her and that he cares about her feelings. He stops repeating himself, and she starts listening. Notice that Ron begins paraphrasing by responding not to what Rachel says, but to what she doesn't say, that she's frustrated. It's a fundamental rule. Feelings crave acknowledgement. And unless they get the acknowledgement they need, feelings can cause trouble in the conversation, like a kid desperate for attention, positive or negative. If you provide that acknowledgement, you give the other person and the relationship something quite precious, something perhaps that they can only get from you. Why is acknowledgement so important? Because attached to each expression of feelings is a set of invisible questions. Are my feelings okay? Do you understand them? Do you care about them? Do you care about me? These questions are important, and we have trouble moving on in a conversation until we know the answers. Taking time to acknowledge the other person's feelings says loud and clear that the answer to each question is yes. An acknowledgement is simply this: any indication that you're struggling to understand the emotional content of what the other person is saying. If the other person says to you, "I'm confused by the fact that you lied to me," you might say any of the following. "Well, it won't happen again. I should explain to you that I did not lie." Or, "It sounds like you're overreacting here a bit." Each of these is an understandable response. The first two respond to the substance of what is being said. The third judges the feeling. but none simply acknowledges the feeling or responds to the invisible questions. In contrast, any of the following would count as an acknowledgement. It sounds like you're really upset about this. This seems really important to you. If I were in your shoes, I'd probably feel confused also. There's no one perfect thing to say. In fact, you may not need to say anything. Sometimes you can acknowledge the other person with a simple nod or even by the look in your eyes. Ultimately, of course, people want their problems addressed. Questions like, what are we going to do about this? Why did you do what you did? How do you explain what happened? These questions are important. But order matters. Whether they say it or not, people often need some acknowledgement of feelings before they can move on to the what happened conversation. Too often in difficult conversations and with the best of intentions, we skip right to problem solving without acknowledging, and the loss is significant. You're working too hard, says your husband. I never see you anymore. You realize he's right and say, well, for the next month, my workload's a lot lighter. I can make a real effort to be home by 6. Your husband doesn't seem satisfied, and you're left wondering what more you could have said. But your husband's complaint is not a math problem. You may think you've solved the problem, but his invisible questions haven't been addressed. Your husband wants his feelings acknowledged. It's been a tough time these last few months, hasn't it? Or, it sounds like you've been feeling really lonely, would be more appropriate responses. Problem solving is important, but it has to wait. The most common concern that arises around the issue of acknowledging is this. What if I don't agree with what the other person is saying? This is an important question. It's useful to distinguish here between the feelings conversation and the what happened conversation. While you may not agree with the substance of what the other person is saying, you can still acknowledge the importance of their feelings. For example,
I have worked so hard for you. Now you're shipping me out. It's just not fair. I've been a loyal team player, and now what's going to happen to me?
It sounds like you're really feeling hurt and betrayed, and I could see why that would be upsetting.
So you agree with me that this is unfair?
Well, what I'm saying is that I can see how upset you're feeling, and it hurts me to see you upset. I also think I understand why you think this transfer is unfair, and why it could feel like I've betrayed your loyalty. Those factors made the decision to transfer you very difficult for me. I fought hard to make this work. I feel badly about how it's turned out. And I do think it's the right decision. And overall, I don't think it's unfair. We can talk more, and probably should, about why.
It requires thought to make these kinds of distinctions, but it can help immensely. Too often we assume that either we have to agree or disagree with the other person. In fact, we can acknowledge the power and importance of the feelings while disagreeing with the substance of what is being said. The deepest form of understanding another person is empathy. Empathy involves a shift from my observing how you seem on the outside to my imagining what it feels like to be you on the inside, wrapped in your skin with your set of experiences and background, and looking out at the world through your eyes. As an empathetic listener, you're on a journey with a direction but no destination. You'll never arrive. You'll never be able to say, I truly understand you. We're all far too complex for that, and our skills to imagine ourselves into other people's lives too limited. But in a sense, that's good news. Psychologists have found that we're each more interested in knowing that the other person is trying to empathize with us, that they're willing to struggle to understand how we feel and how we see things, than we are in believing that they've actually accomplished that goal. The effort, it turns out, is more important than the outcome.
Expression. Speak for yourself with clarity and power. Beginning from the third story is a productive way to open a conversation. Listening to the other person's story with a real desire to learn what they are thinking and feeling is a crucial next step. But understanding them is rarely the end of the matter. The other person also needs to hear your story. You need to express yourself. Expressing yourself well in a difficult conversation has nothing to do with how big your vocabulary is or how eloquent or quick-witted you are. Winston Churchill and Martin Luther King Jr. were great orators, but in difficult conversations, their powers of oration would be of no particular assistance. In a difficult conversation, your primary task is to express what you see and why you see it that way, how you feel, and maybe who you are. Self-knowledge and the belief that what you want to share is important will take you significantly further than eloquence and wit. First, we take up the issue of entitlement. To communicate with clarity and power, you must first negotiate yourself into a place where you truly believe that what you want to express is worthy of expression, a belief that your views and feelings are as important as anyone else's, period. In an essay in her book, Sister Outsider, poet and activist Audre Lorde pondered the question of expression and entitlement shortly after she learned she had breast cancer. "I have come to believe that what is most important to me must be spoken, made verbal and shared, even at the risk of having it bruised or misunderstood. In becoming forcibly and essentially aware of my mortality and of what I wished and wanted for my life, however short it might be, priorities and omissions became strongly etched in a merciless light, and what I most regretted were my silences. I was going to die, if not sooner than later, whether or not I had ever spoken myself. My silences had not protected me. Your silence will not protect you. We can learn to work and speak when we are afraid in the same way we've learned to work and speak when we are tired. For we have been socialized to respect fear more than our own needs for language and definition. And while we wait in silence for that final luxury of fearlessness, the weight of that silence will choke us." Lorde sees substantial risks in expressing oneself, but she recognizes that the costs of silence are even greater. Recognizing your entitlement can help you find your voice in a conversation and the courage to stand up for yourself when you feel frightened or powerless. Sometimes we can feel trapped between the belief that we should stand up for ourselves and a hidden feeling that we don't deserve to be heard, that we're not entitled. In this situation, our unconscious mind can offer a devious and illusory solution. We go through the motions of trying, but incompetently, so that in the end we fail. We wait to speak until there's not enough time to deal with our concerns. We conveniently forget our materials. All our points suddenly disappear from our head. And voila, all our interests are satisfied. We can feel good about trying, and secretly satisfied that we didn't succeed. This is the art of self-sabotage. If this feels like a familiar trick in your repertoire, then you may need to pay more attention to when you are feeling ambivalent. When you sense that vaguely sick or confused feeling, imagine an enormous stop sign to halt you in your tracks. Before proceeding, you need to engage your identity conversation. Why aren't you feeling entitled? Whose voice from your past you hear in your head telling you you're not? What would you need to feel fully entitled to speak up? The ferry tickets to the island of Martha's Vineyard, Massachusetts, read like many transportation tickets. Perforated in the middle, the ticket carries a warning that it will be void if detached. We run the same risks in difficult conversations. When we fail to share what's most important to us, we detach ourselves from others and damage our relationships. Most of us actually prefer being with someone who will speak their mind. Angela broke off her engagement because her fiancé was too nice. He never stated a preference, never argued, never raised his voice, never asked for anything. While she appreciated his kindness, she felt something was missing. Him. If you were sometimes lonely or despondent and never share this with those close to you, then you deny them the chance to come to know a part of you. You presume that they will not respect or like or admire you as much if they knew the way you really think and feel. But it's hard to present only this sanitized version of yourself. Often, to hide parts of who we are, we end up hiding all of who we are. And so we present a front that appears lifeless and removed. Expressing yourself can be difficult and trying, but it gives the relationship a chance to change and to become stronger. Callie, a Native American woman, did not feel particularly close to her co-workers at a tutoring program for troubled teens. Partly because they were white, she suspected they wouldn't really understand her. Indeed, she often found them to be insensitive. But one day she took a risk and shared some stories. She described how she had been called names and teased when she was younger, and how for years she yearned to be normal. These revelations significantly changed her relationship with her colleagues, who came to have great admiration for her. Her colleagues, in turn, felt encouraged to share their own stories of feeling left out or awkward. If Callie had not shared her story, she would have deprived her colleagues of the chance to rebut a stereotype she herself harbored, that white people don't understand and don't care. And she wouldn't have offered them the opportunity, perhaps for the first time, to understand and care about her. A relationship takes hold and grows when both participants experience themselves and the other as being authentic. Such relationships are both more comfortable, it's more relaxing to be yourself, and nourishing to the soul. My boss knows some of my vulnerabilities and still thinks I'm okay. You are entitled to express yourself. If you do not believe this to your core, then you've got some work to do. But being entitled doesn't mean you're obligated. That turns entitlement into another way to beat yourself up. I should be saying what's on my mind, but I'm too afraid. I can't do anything right. Expressing yourself is often extremely difficult. Finding the courage to do it is a lifelong process. If you aren't doing it as much as you'd like, it's something to work on, but not something to punish yourself about. The first step toward expressing yourself is finding your sense of entitlement to speak up. The next step is figuring out what exactly you want to say. There's no better place to begin your story than with what is at the very heart of the matter for you. For me, what this is really about is what I'm feeling, what is important to me is. Sharing what is important to you is common sense, and yet it's advice we often neglect. Consider the story of Charlie, the oldest of four brothers, who wants to improve his relationship with his youngest brother, 16-year-old Gage. Gage is dyslexic, which is especially tough since his older brothers all graduated near the top of their high school classes and went to college on academic scholarships. Gage struggles in school. He's prone to act out, and he has increasingly turned to drinking for solace. Charlie wants to help Gage by offering the benefit of his experience and advice. You should definitely do the debate team. The coach is great, and it will help your college applications. And, you know, Gage, don't overdo the drinking thing. It can be really bad news. But whatever Charlie says makes Gage feel criticized, defensive, and patronized. As a result, the two brothers have grown increasingly distant. When we asked Charlie why the relationship is important to him, the story took a very different turn. Charlie, it turns out, admires the way Gage works so hard to succeed. He feels badly about how he treated Gage when they were younger. And ultimately, it turned out that Charlie needs deeply to feel like a good brother, who loves and is loved in turn. As he revealed this, Charlie cried. When Charlie finally shared these things with his brother, Gage was riveted. Charlie needed him. Charlie needed Gage's help in being a good brother. It proved a turning point in their relationship. Gage would have had to be a mind reader to perceive even a hint of these meanings in Charlie's original communication. The heart of the message simply wasn't there. Nor was there a hint of the enormous depth of the feelings at stake. Instead, there was a completely different message in its place. You're a screw-up who needs my help and is too dumb to ask for it. This is unfortunately all too typical of many difficult conversations. We say the least important things, sometimes over and over again, and wonder why the other person doesn't realize what we really think and how we really feel. As you embark upon a difficult conversation, ask yourself, have I said what is at the heart of the matter for me? Have I shared what is really at stake? If not, Ask yourself why, and see if you can find the courage to try. One way we often skirt sharing things that are important to us is by embedding them in the subtext of the conversation, rather than simply stating them outright. We try to get our message across indirectly, through jokes, questions, offhand comments, or body language. Bringing it up by not quite bringing it up seems a happy medium between avoiding and engaging. It is a way of doing neither and doing both. The problem is, to the extent you were doing both, you're doing both badly. You end up triggering all the problems you worried you'd create by bringing it up without getting the benefit of clearly saying what you want to say. Imagine that you and your husband have usually spent Saturdays sleeping in, puttering around the house, walking the dog, or doing errands together. Recently, however, he has discovered golf and has begun playing 18 holes every Saturday morning. Your Saturday regime has never been particularly important. It's not like it was a date or something. But now that it's gone, you're missing it. The two of you don't spend much time alone together during the rest of the week, and as a result, you're feeling more and more irritated with his new hobby. You could avoid conflict altogether by simply saying nothing. Though, as we've seen, your unhappiness would probably still leak out in spite of yourself. Or you might try to bring it up indirectly. Honey, there's really a lot to be done around the house this weekend. Is golf so important that you need to play it this often? Honey, you are simply playing too much golf. None of these comments conveys what you really mean, which is, I want to spend more time with you. Let's consider the text and subtext of what each statement is saying. Honey, there's really a lot to be done around the house this weekend. This comment falls short on several grounds. First, it's simply the wrong subject. Working around the house is related to, but different from, spending time together. Second, even if work were the issue, the statement is shared as truth. Your husband can reply, there's not that much to do, and we'll talk about it when I get back. Is golf so important that you need to play it this often? This is a classic example of a statement masquerading as a question. It's obvious that the meaning of the comment is conveyed in the subtext. What is less obvious is what the meaning is supposed to be. Your tone conveys anger or frustration, but it's not clear what is causing the anger or what your husband is supposed to do about it. Are you angry that your husband is engaged in a meaningless sport rather than community service or household chores? Are you angry that he's not taking you along? Are you angry that you aren't spending enough time together? How would he know? Honey, you are simply playing too much golf. This statement is an opinion couched as a fact. Your husband is left to wonder, too much golf in relation to what? How much golf is too much golf? How much would be an appropriate amount of golf? Even if I am playing too much golf, so what? Of course, even if he knew the answers to these questions, he would not have received the message intended. The gap between you are playing too much golf and I would like to spend more time with you is just too great. To do better, you need to figure out what you are really thinking and feeling and then say it directly. I'd like to spend more time with you, and Saturday morning was one of the few times we had to spend together. As a result, I'm finding your interest in golf irritating. Sometimes you'll find yourself wishing you didn't have to be explicit. You wish the other person already knew that there was a problem and would do something about it. This is a common and understandable fantasy. Our ideal mate or perfect colleague should be able to read our mind and meet our needs without our having to ask. Unfortunately, such people don't exist. Over time, we may come to know better how we each think and feel, but we will never be perfect. Being disappointed that someone isn't reading our mind is one of our contributions to the problem. A related and often destructive way to communicate through subtext is what Professor Chris Argyris has called easing in. Easing in is where you try to soften a message by delivering it indirectly through hints and leading questions. This is all too common in performance reviews. So, how do you think you've done? Do you think you've really done as much as you could have? I have the same problem.
but it probably would have been a little better to, wouldn't you agree? Easing in conveys three messages. I have a view. This is too embarrassing to discuss directly. And I'm not going to be straight with you. Not surprisingly, these messages increase both sides' anxiety and defensiveness. And the recipient's imagination almost always conjures up the message worse than the real one. A better approach is to make the subject clear and discussable by stating your thoughts straight out, while also indicating, honestly, that you are interested in whether the other person sees the situation differently, and if so, how. Based on what I know, it seems to me that you might have gotten more done. However, you know more about what happened. In what ways would you see it differently? Then, if you disagree, you can talk directly about how to test or otherwise reconcile or deal with your different views. We've all learned that for others to understand us, we need to make what we say clear and simple. Fair enough as far as it goes. The problem is, what's going on in our heads is often a jumble of complex thoughts, feelings, assumptions, and perceptions. When we try to be simple, we often end up being incomplete. Imagine that you receive a memo from a coworker that leaves you confused. You are thinking, this memo shows incredible creativity, and at the same time is so badly organized that it makes me crazy. In your attempt to be clear, you say, your memo is so badly organized it makes me crazy. Or worse, your memo makes me crazy. You can avoid oversimplifying by using the me-me and. The and stance recognizes that each of our various perceptions, feelings, and assumptions is important to talk about. This is true of the other person's perceptions and your perceptions, the other person's feelings and yours. It's also true of the various perceptions, feelings, and assumptions that are going on just inside you. The and in this case is connecting two aspects of what you think and feel. And though complex, it's both clear and accurate. Me, me, and statements sound like this. I do think you are bright and talented, and I think you're not working hard enough. I feel bad for how rough things have been for you, and I'm feeling disappointed in you. I'm upset with myself for not noticing that you were so lonely, and I was also having my own problems during that time. I feel relieved and happy that I finally went through with the divorce. It was the right decision, and I do miss him sometimes. The me, me, and is also useful for overcoming a common obstacle to starting a difficult conversation, the fear of being misunderstood. You think your team would be the best one to take on a new client, but fear that asking for the assignment will sound self-serving, that you're only in it for glory and the bonus. If this is the fear, share it along with your argument. I have a view on this that I want to share, and I have to say that I'm nervous about doing so because I'm afraid it may sound self-serving. So if you see anything in what I say that doesn't seem legitimate, please say so and let's discuss it. Or in a different situation, I'm having a strong reaction here that I'd like to share, and I'm worried about feeling embarrassed if I'm not able to be clear or unemotional at first. I hope if that happens, you'll bear with me and help me stay with it until I can put it succinctly. Obviously, how you express yourself makes a difference. How you say what you want to say will determine in part how others respond to you and how the conversation will go. So when you choose to share something important, you'll want to do so in a way that will maximize the chance that the other person will understand and respond productively. Clarity is the key. Some aspects of difficult conversations will continue to be rough, even when you communicate with great skill. Sharing feelings of vulnerability, delivering bad news, learning something painful about how others see you. But presenting your story as the truth, which creates resentment, defensiveness, and leads to arguments, is a wholly avoidable disaster. It's an easy mistake to make. It's based on an error of thought. You often experience your beliefs, opinions, and judgments as facts. When you're arguing about a favorite movie, or food, or sports hero, sharing judgment as the truth is fine. But in difficult conversations, it doesn't wash. Facts are facts. Everything else is everything else. And you need to be scrupulously vigilant about the distinction. If you and your friend disagree about whether it is ever okay to spank your child, you add to the conflict if you state your view as the truth. Spanking children is just plain wrong. This statement muddies the already turbulent waters, and your friend may hear it as accusatory or presumptuous. Instead of engaging you on the issue, your friend may react by saying, "Who are you to proclaim what's right and wrong?" Far better to say any of these: "I believe spanking children is wrong," or "I've read several books that say spanking children is harmful to them," or "I was spanked as a child and I feel sad and frightened when I hear of a child being spanked," or even, "I'm not sure why I feel this way, but I just feel so strongly that spanking children is wrong." Each of these clearly distinguishes between what your view or feeling is and what the facts are. Some words, like attractive, ugly, good, and bad, carry judgments that are obvious. But be careful with words like inappropriate, should, or professional. The judgments contained in these words are less obvious but can still provoke the "who are you to tell me" response. If you want to say something is inappropriate, preface your judgment with "my view is that." Better still, avoid these words altogether. This is not an argument that there is no truth or that all opinions are equally valid. It simply distinguishes opinion from fact and allows you to have a careful discussion that leads to better understanding and better decisions rather than to defensiveness and pointless fighting. The first step toward clarity, then, is to share your conclusions and opinions as your conclusions and opinions and not as the truth. The second step is to share what's beneath your conclusions, the information you have and interpretations you make that lead you to conclude as you do. As we suggested earlier, you have information about yourself that the other person has no access to. That kind of information can be important. Consider sharing it. And you have life experiences that are influencing what you think and why, as well as how you feel. When you tell these stories, it puts some meat onto the bones of your views. You and your wife argue about whether to send your daughter, Carol, to private school. Your wife says, "I really think we should do it this year. It's an important age, and I know we can come up with the money." You say in response, "I think she's doing fine in public school. I think we should keep her there." If this conversation is going to get anywhere, the two of you need to share where these conclusions come from. What specific information is in your heads? What past experiences influence how you're thinking about this? You need to share your own experience in private school, the fear you felt the first few months, the sense of never quite fitting in, how guilty you felt that your parents weren't able to buy a car because they were paying your tuition for so many years. Tell that story with all the vividness and detail that's in your head as you discuss your concerns about the decision. Nothing else you say will make sense if your wife is unaware of the experiences that inform your feelings on this subject. Also, we should avoid expressing our frustration through a bit of exaggeration. "Why do you always criticize my clothes?" You never give one word of appreciation or encouragement. The only time anyone hears anything from you is when there's something wrong. Always and never do a pretty good job of conveying frustration, but they have two serious drawbacks. First, it is seldom strictly accurate that someone criticizes every time, or that they haven't at some point said something positive. Using such words invites an argument over the question of frequency. "That's not true. I said several nice things to you last year when you won the inter-office new idea competition," a response that will most likely increase your exasperation. Always and never also make it harder rather than easier for the other person to consider changing their behavior. In fact, always and never suggest that change will be difficult or impossible. The implicit message is, "What's wrong with you such that you were driven to criticize my clothes?" Or perhaps even, "You are obviously incapable of ever acting like a normal person." A better approach is to proceed as if, however hard it may be to believe, the other person is simply unaware of the impact of his actions on you, and, being a good person, would certainly wish to change their behavior once they became aware of it. You could say something like, "When you tell me my suit reminds you of wrinkled old curtains, I feel hurt. Criticizing my clothes feels like an attack on my judgment." If you can also suggest what you would wish to hear instead, so much the better. I wish I could feel more often like you believed in me. It would really feel great to hear even something as simple as, "I think that color looks good on you." Anything, as long as it was positive. The key is to communicate your feelings in a way that invites and encourages the recipient to consider new ways of behaving, rather than suggesting they're a schmuck and it's too bad there's nothing they can do about it. It's not easy to step into someone else's story. It's especially hard when the issues are emotionally charged or when your views are rooted in a different generation or radically dissimilar corporate culture. You'll need their help in understanding them, and they'll need your help in understanding you. If you feel overwhelmed with anxiety when leaving your children with a babysitter, and your husband says that you should just learn to relax, you can express your anxiety in terms he might understand. It's like your fear of flying. You know how when I try to tell you to relax during takeoff, it has no impact, and in fact it makes it worse? Well, this is the same sort of thing. And recognize that different people take in information at different speeds and in different ways. For example, some people prefer to get their arms around the whole problem first and can't listen to anything else you say until they do. Others like all the details up front. Pay attention to these differences. Paraphrasing the other person helps you check your understanding and helps them know you've heard. You can ask them to do the same thing for you. Let me check to see if I'm being clear. Would you mind just playing back what you've heard me say so far? Explaining your story clearly is a first step toward being understood, but don't expect instant success. Real understanding may take some back and forth. If the other person seems puzzled or unpersuaded by your story, rather than putting it more forcefully or trying to tell it in a different way, ask how they see it. In particular, ask how they see it differently. A common tendency is to ask for agreement, perhaps because it's reassuring. Does that make sense? Wouldn't you agree? But asking the other person how they see it differently is more helpful. If you ask for agreement, people may be reluctant to share their doubts and reservations. They aren't sure whether you really want to hear them. They say, "Yes, I suppose so," but you don't know whether they're actually thinking, "Yes, in a limited, warped kind of way that's just like you." If you ask explicitly for how they see it differently, you are more likely to discover their true reaction. Then you can begin to have a real conversation. The secret of powerful expression is recognizing that you are the ultimate authority on you. You are an expert on what you think, how you feel, and why you've come to this place. If you think it or feel it, you are entitled to say it, and no one can legitimately contradict you. You only get in trouble if you try to assert what you are not the final authority on. Who's right? Who intended what? What happened? Speak fully the range of your experience, and you will be clear. Speak for yourself, and you can speak with power.
Problem solving. Take the lead. It may be that the person you're talking to has listened to this program and understands how to engage in a learning conversation, but don't count on it. More likely, you'll talk about understanding and they'll talk about who's right. You'll talk about contribution while they're stuck in blame. You'll bend over backward to listen and acknowledge their feelings, and in return you'll be attacked, interrupted, and judged. You're doing your best to improve the way the two of you communicate. They're doing their best to ensure that no constructive communication ever occurs between you. What to do? If your conversations are going to get anywhere, you're going to have to take the lead. There are a set of powerful moves you can make during the conversation, reframing, listening, and naming the dynamic, that can help you keep the conversation on track, whether the other person is being cooperative or not. Reframing means taking the essence of what the other person says and translating it into concepts that are more helpful, specifically concepts from the Three Conversations framework. You begin walking down a new path and inviting the other person to join you. You're illuminating the way. Let's return to the situation between Miguel and Sydney. Recall that Sydney is leading a team of engineers on a project in Brazil. After initially resisting her leadership, Miguel has become Sydney's most ardent supporter. Unfortunately for Sydney, Miguel's enthusiasm has apparently progressed to romantic interest as well. When Sydney steps away from her own focus on blame, she begins to see the mixed signals she may be sending to Miguel. She realizes that by not expressing her discomfort directly, she is contributing to the situation. Sydney decides to raise the issue with Miguel. She knows that for the conversation to be successful, she's going to have to be persistent in reframing the conversation from blame to contribution. We pick up the dialogue partway in. I should have brought this up with you earlier, which is one of the reasons it's really important to me to talk about it now.
Of course you should bring it up with me if you feel uncomfortable. This is the reason you're uncomfortable. A team leader should know how to handle this better.
Well, whether I should or I shouldn't, I guess I didn't. It makes sense to me that by not bringing it up, I probably exacerbated the problem. But rather than focus on which one of us is to blame, I'm trying to figure out how we got into this spot in the first place. I think we each did, or maybe didn't do, some things that made the situation worse.
Well, I think this whole thing is because you're American. American women, they're a little oversensitive about this issue. It creates problems where there aren't any.
Look, you and I could probably argue all day about whether or not American women are oversensitive. What's important is perhaps that you and I are coming from very different cultural perspectives on this. So I experienced your comments as suggestive and pretty uncomfortable. And you seem to see our interactions as not out of place in a working relationship, is that right?
That's true. For me, what I did was normal, not a big deal.
When you say normal, do you mean normal for two people in just a professional relationship? Or do you mean normal for two people in a professional relationship that they might choose to pursue something more?
Either one. We should be able to tease each other. I can tell you how much I like you. If you're not interested, you can ignore it. If you are, you can respond in kind. The problem here is that you're overreacting, and you should have brought this up sooner.
As I said in the beginning, I agree with you. If I'd brought it up earlier, we might have avoided some of this. I guess I felt frustrated because I was trying to ignore it, but you kept persisting anyway. You know, like when I kept turning down your invitations to have a drink in the bar or take walks alone on the beach.
You know, there were times I could tell something was wrong. I suppose I could have asked if things were okay or if I had offended you for some reason. And maybe we should have just talked about our expectations and been upfront with each other.
With this last statement, Miguel is finally starting to sense the difference between contribution and blame, and is starting to feel comfortable enough to begin to acknowledge his own contribution. But to get to this point, Sydney had to be persistent in redirecting him away from blame. Reframing works on all fronts. You can reframe anything they say to move toward a learning conversation. Consider these examples. If they say, "I'm right and there are no two ways about it," you can reframe by saying, "I want to make sure I understand your perspective. You obviously feel very strongly about it. And I'd also like to share my perspective on the situation." If they say, "You hurt me on purpose," you can reframe by saying, "I can see that you're feeling really angry about what I did, which is upsetting for me. It wasn't my intention. Can you say more about how you felt?" If they say, "This is all your fault," you can reframe by saying, "I'm sure I've contributed to the problem. I think we both have. Rather than focus on whose fault this is, I'd like just to look at how we got here and how we contributed to the situation." If they say, "You're the nastiest person I've ever met," you can reframe by saying, "It sounds like you're feeling really bad." Of course, one sentence alone is unlikely to do the trick, but these examples give you a sense of where to start. Like Sydney, you'll need to be persistent, and you should expect to be constantly reframing the conversation to help keep it on a productive track. A second reframing move you can make is from either or to and. If the other person is setting up a choice between what you think and what they think, between how you feel and how they feel, you can reject that choice by moving to the and stance. We've already talked about the me-me and, but in terms of managing the interactive conversation, it's the you-me and that is crucial.